Paper 16, section 9, sold single column, page 195. Last section here in paper 16. Upon reflection over the past week, it will probably take us all night to do it. there's a couple things I want to expand on a little bit. So just remember that, we're going to be doing the third section of this three-section essay on the three cosmic intuitions, and you'll see them very definitively in play again. But just like the previous section, there's more in play as well. There's also picking up on what they started in the previous section, your branch of personality, and bringing down very specifically some more about that, what it means to be functioning as a human, to actually be manifesting personality. And we all want to be courageous and not want to exalt our fancy animal. We're all going to challenge. And the whole point is to really challenge yourself to not be afraid to recognize you're a child of God. And no child is mature. So that all of us are starting with mostly fancy animal, which historically there's been a tendency to call personal. But it's actually not. And it's not meaningless, valueless, purposeless. It's definitively scaffolding. And so, that's really what you're attempting to do, is to discern your scaffolding, climb to the top of it, stand on the top of the scaffolding, and work up from there, rather than exalting the scaffolding, and declaring it's the building. It's just the scaffolding. So you can see the title, reality, again, of human consciousness. They're going to stress that reality in contrast to just the actuality, or even more so, the scaffolding in advance of the actuality. All right, so let's jump in.
9, reality of human consciousness. The cosmic mind-endowed, adjuster-indwelt, personal creature possesses innate recognition realization of energy reality, mind reality, and spirit reality. The will creature is thus equipped to discern the fact, the law, and the love of God. Aside from these three inalienables of human consciousness, all human experience is really subjective, except that intuitive realization of validity attaches to the unification of these three universe reality responses of cosmic recognition.
Pretty obviously threefold actuality happening there. A little bit of levels of meaning to start out with there too. You notice those keywords of recognition and realization. And since we've focused on it a lot, you might have been struck by the order in the hyphenated construct there. You're going, well, wait a minute, doesn't go up from recognition to realization, so shouldn't recognition be the foundation point and with realization added to that foundation of recognition? So shouldn't it be the other way around? Well, the point in the sentence is to parallel how they started. The cosmic mind endowed. Okay, so the Holy Spirit gives you recognition. Adjuster indwelt. Remember up in the adjuster papers that time when they refer to the adjuster as the realityizer? Yeah. Now, of course, technically, what allows an adjuster to be, to realityize something? The adjuster is entirely, always subservient to your will. Now, your will is wielding the adjuster and allowing it to be a realityizer, and very literally, you know, constructing your soul, making that potentially eternal reality copy of your selfhood, your potentially ongoing nature. So it starts out in the recognition realization order, see, and then they're just paralleling that. Okay. But then there's the energy, mind, spirit. So there's the threefold actuality. You know, all put as adjectives on reality. Just down here in the personality block. So you can see they're what they're getting at. Now this one we haven't seen before. To put it put the threefold actuality as fact, law, and love. The fact, the law, and the love of God. Fact, that first cosmic intuition, is that foundational discrimination between fact and figment. The ability to recognize a fact as a fact, in contrast to a figment. Law, your moral discrimination. Law of God. And then, of course, your spiritual insight, that's, you know, that primary immediate channel for connecting with your personality to the person of God, who is love. So another way of thinking about the threefold actuality, fact, law, love, and then they throw down the gauntlet again. Now, how do they express that? They say, aside from these three inalienables of human consciousness, inalienables of human consciousness. Okay, so you have a really, really smart, he's a super high IQ person. Okay, they seem to be cutting edge blob of protoplasm shaped like this. Okay, but they are absolutely certain that there is no fact of God. Are they functioning as a human? No. Doesn't matter how high their IQ is. Doesn't matter how much schooling they have, how much book learning they've got. Some simple little person for whom God is obvious trumps
Mr. Wizard.
That very advanced, educated, scholarly individual. One simple little act of clear insight, and he puts himself on top. Okay? Right. They're inalienables. It's an if and only if. you can't have one without the other. They go hand in hand. Personality manifestation, definitely knows not just the love of God either, and the fact of God. So think about it on the other side. A religionist, a person that you might initially want to label as a religionist, they talk a lot about the love of God, the fact of God. They don't have any hesitation about that, but they're kind of off in no man's land about that whole law thing, that whole morality thing. They've decided that that's that old fundamentalist stuff, that all that moralism stuff, and they're an advanced spiritual thinker that's kind of moved beyond all that moralism. Okay, all three, they're three inalienables. You know, if you're a spiritually conscious person, but you're fuzzy on the law of God, okay, it's not wholly personal what's happening there. It has to be all three. The only time that personality can actually manifest is when it's engaging and through that triunity. It must be triune, or it's not actually personal. It's half-hearted, it's pre-human, it's potential, But it's not fully there. So very, you know, it's a very definitive statement. All human experience is really subjective, see. Outside of the three cosmic intuitions. That's why on the chart here, you know, you have in each block, you have a subjective line and an objective line. The objective line with the intuition, the cosmic intuition. You know, in the first three blocks, you have that simple pattern, subjective, objective. Yeah.
Can you give a clear definition of what subjective is?
Just that you have no way of functioning, thinking independently. You're wholly subject to some external initialization, boundary condition, a priori assumption, like we were talking about, helpless victim, you know, those. You're subject. You're a subject to some external fact. You can't stand on your own. Courageous and independent, objective cosmic thinking. Okay? So, there you have that. But then, you know, you notice there's a qualification. Except, so first they're just pointing out how there's these subjective-objective lines, agitant mind relative to the intuition, subjective-objective. And then they say, except that intuitive realization of validity attaches to the unification of these three universe reality responses. Together as one. So there's that personality component that's there also. You have the gift from the mother, encirclement of the Holy Spirit, so you have the three cosmic intuitions, which is obviously going to give you objective potential. It's coming from God. But it's not just the mother, there's also the Father. So whatever you get from that is going to have an objective potential in it as well. So down here in the personality block on the chart, you have a subjective-objective again. Okay? And on that objective line, and here, I've brought in the Spirit of Truth, and that alternate designation, the Spirit of Unification. What was the italicized word in this paragraph? Coincidentally, it's unification. Right? See, another thing about alternatively referring to it as the Spirit of Unification, it's reminding you that it's only through the triunity that truth flows. It's a very definitively wholehearted personal phenomenon. Okay? So that unification. So that's what they're just, you know, in just a few words, they're bringing up this whole structure of contrast between subjective and objective, the three fold with the fourth. Threefold actuality with unity. Okay? And it'll never fail you. You figure out the pattern in one place here. Every time they use unification, they're keying you back to that. So you can build and build and build your recognition in that area. They're not going to use that word randomly. It's always going to have some definitive focalization in that same space again. You might be taking the thing in that space and looking at it from a different angle or something, okay? But it's in the same space, you know, like, you know, simplistically, it's going to be in the same block of the chart, for instance. Okay, so threefold actuality, a little bit of gauntlet about some humility, a little reminder that we all start out as children. And until you have an unwavering, inalienable connection to the cosmos, there's not a steady personal phenomenon happening there. Might happen for a little bit, and then, you know, then you fall back down again. And yep.
So the Spirit of Wisdom, symmetry, and then subjective. That's where the zeal comes from, right?
No, that's the sixth. Look at spirit of zeal is the sixth, and the next block up. Right here.
Right. Then how could the spirit of wisdom be subjective?
Okay. In and of itself, just purely as itself, and really, you know, in and of itself, it's none of them are the spirit of anything, really. It's the Holy Spirit encirclement that turns them into the spirit of something. You have this energy of symmetry. You have this mindal energy, this consciousness ability that that seventh adjutant gives you to go, you know, I could kind of understand things by thinking about my two hands, and I could put something in each hand, and I could kind of weigh them back and forth. It's like, well, on the one hand, there's this, and on the other hand, there's this. It's like, you know, what's the balance between these two things? What's the proportion between them? That's your seventh adjutant, just in and of itself, that's allowing you to have that thought of contrasting back and forth, you know, in mental scales like that, weighing the two sides of something. But wholly in and of itself, it gets stuck there. It can't go any further than six of one, half a dozen of another.
Kind of like a slinky.
Right? The thing that breaks the six of one, half a dozen of another is your moral discrimination. That objective perspective that comes down and says, yeah, to you subjectively, it looks like six of one, half a dozen another. It looks like they're the same. Objectively, this is right and this is wrong. It's like, well, how do you know that? They feel this, the same weight. Well, it's self-evident to objective consciousness. Because the objective consciousness isn't just limited to feeling them on the outside where they feel the same. It's an insight. It penetrates inside of the two things that are in the scales and sees that one is solid and one is hollow. But on the outside, they feel the same. Subjectively, they feel the same. Same way with fact and figment. Those forms subjectively are identical in the mind. You know, remember, it's a literal form in your mindal energy system, this fact thing or this figment thing. It's a literal shape, okay? And if you grab it subjectively and feel the two of them, there is not the slightest shred of difference. They feel exactly the same. You know how in a dream you can't tell it's figment. It seems just as factual as anything else, okay? I mean, there's no difference subjectively. But objectively, with your first cosmic intuition, you see that one is hollow and one is solid. You have insight. That's how you tell.
54:17, I remember, even wisdom is divine and safe only when it is cosmic in scope and spiritual in motivation.
Right, she knows that. That's the one paragraph, and it's a single paragraph, or single sentence paragraph. That's the one spot in the book up there in 54 that directly is referring to this fact, that in and of itself, the seventh adjutant is subjective. Okay, paper 54, Problems of the Lucifer Rebellion, because that's where the problem begins. There's a lot of things that are common wisdom, quote unquote. You know, humans are playing with these thoughts with their seventh adjutant, and they're certain that this is right, and it's common wisdom. Yeah, well, it's false. It's not true. And insight would tell you that. It doesn't matter how common the common wisdom is. Wisdom in and of itself, the seventh adjutant in and of itself, is subjective and foolable. Okay? Only your three intuitions and with your personality, you know, can be objectively clear. Okay, so see that first paragraph, it's they're just all over the chart. And again, in a fourfold way, like we see they do occasionally. I mean, they, you know, don't just talk in the threefold way, but they bring in that fourth facet of the picture. Okay, let's get another paragraph here.
The God-discerning mortal is able to sense the unification value of these three cosmic qualities in the evolution of the surviving soul, man's supreme undertaking in the physical tabernacle, where the moral mind collaborates with the indwelling divine spirit to dualize the mortal soul. From its earliest inception, the soul is real. It has cosmic survival qualities.
Okay. So just a couple things. I mean, the main point is, you know, especially being stressed at the end. You know, in the full sense of the word real, where you've taken something and you've wrapped it around the infinite, eternal ellipse. You've brought that measure of yourself into relationship with infinity and eternity. Okay. Full-throated reality. Your mortal self obviously isn't like that. It's not in eternal in any way, shape, or form. Your mortal self is mortal. And then, so in a definitive sense, it's not real. But like they're saying, you know, even that embryonic soul, even that initial soul that we all have post-Pentecost by grace, is real from its earliest inception. The soul is real. Because how did it get made? Your personality, even, you know, unconsciously, wielded the adjuster to make it. And and that which the adjuster makes as a consequence of your will is real. You know, he's the realityizer. Okay? All right, so that, just stressing that, you know, and again, just, so you really, you know, that's what you're looking towards. You know, when Jesus is talking about storing up your treasures in heaven, you know, that's what he's trying to get you to focus on. Don't fixate so much on your mortal self, he's saying. I mean, try to do things that build soul, that add bricks to your soul. That's the treasure you want to store up, more bricks of something that actually is real, something that's going to survive. You know, yes, you can't ignore your mortal self. It's the means by which you make the soul, but you know, just it's scaffolding. It's not an end in itself. You know, avoid fixating on it. Think of it as a means to a greater end.
So how do you, if you're subjective, like I'm really subjective a lot, like, you know, at work and stuff.
Very objective of you to observe.
Yeah. I mean, people hurt my feelings and stuff like that. How do you rise above that? I mean, it's, you know.
You just have to. I mean, there's only.
Listen to the old guy.
There's only one thing that anyone can do. See, you know, there's no technique that somehow is going to get God to help you with this. He's given you absolute free will. There's only one being in all the universe that has any control whatsoever over this, and it's you. You have to consecrate your will to His will. It is my will that your will be done. The humility of that, the recognition of the objectivity. I mean, that's a nonsensical statement if there isn't a contrast between the subjective and the objective. If all there is the subjective, then the best you could get is some sort of just consecration of that subjective self. But, you know, to actually recognize that there's something that needs to be parented, and there's a parent on high that could do it. If you just consecrate yourself to not get in the way and let the parent get to the child, a lot of it is just knowing that that's in play. So you know, it's present in your consciousness. I need to remember, I'm not self-guiding. I need to be guided. I need to catch myself taking, you know, undue offense at something. You know, like I've pointed out, I mean, God doesn't have to actually forgive like we usually use that word forgive, because He doesn't take offense. God never takes offense. And what did Jesus say? You can do that too. Go beyond, you know, your merely human limitations. You don't just have to love at a brotherly level. You can love at a fatherly. You can take on God-likeness. You cannot take offense also. It's like, well, but how can I control an energy system that just by design is offended? The parent part of you can rise above that. Perforce you serve two masters. There's nothing you can do about that instinctual response of that subjective energy system. It'll always go, okay? It'll always do that, okay? But you can put a barrier around it. And so it can't get out and be the final word on the moment, you know? Yes, I just felt a tinge there. My subjective self didn't like that. But I don't have to manifest offense. I can demonstrate peace that passes all understanding.
Like overrule.
See, that's what the understanding part is. I mean, people who don't know about objective consciousness are going, well, that's impossible. He was just exposed to something that should have offended him. He should be red-faced right now, and he's not. That's not understandable. He must be a machine or something. No, he's a human. That's what humans do. Animals are belligerent and take offense. And
you get demoted if you don't take offense.
I would think that utilizing the subjective mind to almost any extent promotes fear. This is the origins of fear.
At the foundation of the subjective mind is zeroth level of meaning, is fear. It's all built upon fear. We're going to get to a spot where they refer to changing where your feet are planted. You know, if they're planted in the bottom of the hourglass, fear will always be the final word on the situation. It can't be anything else. That's where your feet are planted. It's the bottom line. If your feet are planted at the top of the hourglass in the cosmos, the universal harmony, okay, it'll be a different bottom line. It'll just be a different bottom line. But it's sad to record that so few persons take delight in changing where their feet are planted.
Yeah, so it just became apparent to me from what you said that Jesus really called us to go beyond brotherly. He called his apostles to go beyond brotherly love. Mm-hmm. Brotherly love is just loving those who love you in return. Mm-hmm. You know,
it's a mutual.
Kind. Mm-hmm. And so you're getting above that, and you're, what did he say? He said, love those who don't love. He said, pray for those who persecute you, you know? I mean, he was going the full length.
Right. Remember, he's calling for not one notch up from the fourth level of meaning. He's calling for two notches up, and really even beyond that, because once you get to the sixth level, then you can start to really become a cosmic character. Mm-hmm. You can begin to rise above the ladder, that initial ladder of meaning, and begin to manifest this very balanced. And that's what Jesus was always so impressive at. You know, how he had all of the different levels of engagement at the ready, because he doesn't have to go up or down. Remember, he's taken the ladder and brought it up and wrapped it around on a horizontal cosmic level. And so he can just bring whatever facet to bear. You know, he doesn't have to alter his relationship to the cosmos vertically. You know, he's just right there. He can just dial in the facet, the face that needs to face that person he's engaging. Okay, let's see. Oh, yeah, there was one other little thing there at the beginning. The God-discerning mortal is able to sense, okay, the unification value of these three cosmic qualities. We referred to that back in, let's see, what is that? That's in paper 12, I think, isn't it? Where, I'm pretty sure, where they, remember how they talk about those different relationships, those different senses of time? And we were understanding why there was, you have progressing mind, and so you can have a sense of the ing, you know, the sequence relative to progressing mind. A notch above that, there is perfecting spirit. So you can have a sense of the ing of the perfecting spirit. But there's an even higher notch, a So you have mind, spirit, but above that's personality. Okay, harmonizing personality. Okay, that triunity level that they're referring to, this sense, see, of unification value. Not just value, that's, you know, that's just spirit in and of itself, but unification value, triunity value, not just mere unity value, triunity value, harmony. You know, harmony's down in this block, this personality block. So that harmonizing personality, you have a sense of the fact of that and the movement of that as well. Okay. And just saying that, now we have really good context for going for picking that up again. When I say harmonizing personality, you should have a little bit of puzzlement. You know, well, wait a minute. I thought personality was this absolutely changeless, constant thing from the Father. Oh, Chris is not talking about, he's not using the word personality in that existential way that they use it sometimes. He's using it in that experiential way, or that, you know, like when we go back to, where was that here? In the 1, 2, 3, third paragraph of the previous section, it ended with organismal vehicle for personality manifestation. When I'm talking about harmonizing personality, I'm talking about a harmonizing personality manifestation. Technically, the manifestation has a moving, harmonizing aspect. The existential source, of course, is changeless. But what you're, you know, manifesting is going through a sequence. It's like this, and then it's better, and then it's better, and then it's better. Yeah. Okay. So
sounds like the selfhood.
So that's just a simple example. Yeah, I mean, it's tied to the selfhood, obviously, but that's a simple example. You the revelators do that all the time. You have to, you know, do they mean technically personality manifestation there when they say personality, or do they literally mean existentially personality? You got to sort it out or you'll misinterpret the sentence. Yeah. All right. So those two things. All right. And, stressing that reality. I mean, even when I get a reality in my higher mortal mind, you know, that even my higher mortal mind dies. So when all is said and done, you know, the only thing that's really real is what's getting copied into the soul and can go on. That duplicate self is. Okay, so, you know, there's a lot of humility and, you know, that comes into play when you really sort this out and recognize, well, I've got a long ways to go. But I can get started right now because of the grace of Pentecost. You know, imagine if you, were an individual that didn't get a thought adjuster at 6, 3,000 years ago, say. You had a lot of work ahead of you. Try to get yourself up to third circler, get an adjuster to even have an embryonic soul. Yeah.
And what kind of guidance did you have?
In the wake of the rebellion and the fault, you know the answer to that. Very little. Yeah. It's an amazingly gracious gift, what was given to us at Pentecost. We can be really primitive and get a soul at age 6 now. That wasn't the case 2,500 years ago. All right, a little more.
If mortal man fails to survive natural death, the real spiritual values of his human experience survive as a part of the continuing experience of the thought adjuster. The personality values of such a non-survivor persist as a factor in the personality of the actualizing supreme being. Such persisting qualities of personality are deprived of identity, but not of experiential values accumulated during the mortal life in the flesh. The survival of identity is dependent on the survival of the immortal soul of Maruncha status and increasingly divine value. Personality identity survives in and by the survival of the soul.
Okay, couple points that, you know, here they are again. So let's go through them again and maybe try to find a slightly different tack at them to again try to firmly get these this sorted out, this very different than anything humans have thought before element of the revelation, this whole bit about death and iniquity and all these sorts of issues. Okay, so if mortal man fails to survive natural death, well, what does that mean? If mortal man fails to survive natural death, they've had, accomplished something pretty amazing in this short life. What have they accomplished? Iniquity. They've achieved iniquity in this short life. That's no small feat, okay, especially post-Pentecost. But, you know, it's possible. So let's just, you know, imagine it is. Imagine they achieve iniquity. So they've evaporated the soul. So there's nothing that can be resurrected. Okay, so, well, there are no iniquitous six-year-olds. Period. Okay? I mean, especially post-Pentecost, where there's a soul, at least an embryonic soul, stemming off of that innocent six-year-old, I mean, there is some value that's in play. And it was probably quite a ways down the line before, you know, there wasn't any value in play in that life. So how does this work? Well, we've, you know, in two different spots in the book, you know, between the Adjuster Papers and the Supreme Papers, we come to understand that we're not an island universe. When we're involved with reality, there is a connection of that reality to very directly to two other facts. Your selfhood is reflected in the adjuster. Okay, now we're talking about your soul. Okay, but remember, the adjuster has an augmenting nature. There's that existential core, but when it engages an experiential creature, it begins to acquire an experiential nature. Where does it, you know, what's that based upon? It's a reflection of the selfhood, you know, in part, it's a reflection of the selfhood of the individual that they're engaged with, that they're imprisoned in to start with. Okay? So there's this reflection of your selfhood in the adjuster. Okay, that's the first thing they're referring to there. The real spiritual values. Okay. So now, if you don't survive, I mean, that adjuster still doesn't have a personality. Okay. So you don't want to use the word personality directly to talk about this, but it's not the only reason the adjuster has this, has acquired this, is because your personality was in play in the system and it acquired this reflection. Okay, so that's why they put real in front of it there. There was personality, there was reality in play. But, you know, just basically in and of itself, it's just spiritual values that that adjuster has acquired, okay, via a real mechanism. So that reflection of your selfhood that the adjuster has, that's that. That there's another reflection of your selfhood in the whole. You know, whether you survive or not, both ways, there's a reflection of your selfhood in the whole, you know, in the supreme, technically, in the almighty part of the supreme, the bottom-up part, you know, you're part of the bottom-up phenomenon. There's a reflection of your bottom-up progress in the whole, in the almighty, in the bottom-up part of the almighty. So there's a reflection of your selfhood in the almighty as well. And here, though, if you choose iniquity, that purposing that was identified with, you know, like if I choose iniquity, the purposing that was identified with this self, it doesn't go to the adjuster, But it does go to the Almighty as part, becomes that part, that purposing becomes a part of the overall purposing of God, the Almighty. The purposing of the Almighty, God the Almighty. And so that reflection of your selfhood that's in the Almighty does have this purposing identified with it. And so you notice how they refer to it. The personality values, see, of such a non-survivor persist. So that's the difference. These two reflections of your selfhood, one in the adjuster and one in the Almighty, but one of them has an ongoing purposing imposed upon it. So it's more than just spiritual values. It's appropriately called personality values still. But it's not you anymore, and that's the rest of the paragraph, where they're bringing in that additional technicality of what's the difference between a self and an identity. So if you have a self, any kind of self, whatever kind of self, but in this case we're considering your mortal self, you know, personality engages a self, makes that self an identity. So a self that's has personality engaged to it, identified to it with it, becomes an identity. That's what that word technically means. So you have a self is a delimited thing. It's not the whole. You know, it's not like the supreme self. Okay? You have this little self, me, for instance, and I get personality engaged to my little self. And this self now has a greater integrity than a mere mindful self. It has this personality grasp around it, and it warrants it being called by a different name to indicate the difference, the greater solidity of it when it has sort of the Father's hands, as it were, you know, wrapped around it. It's an identity now. Okay. If I choose iniquity, see, those hands around myself go away and the self evaporates at the same time. Okay. That reflection of my selfhood in the Almighty is God the Almighty. There is a grip, but it's not the same self. It's a different self. You know, you've got a drop of water that goes into an ocean, see, in that case, basically. Okay, and there's bigger hands. There is an identity there, but it's not the former identity. It's not like my identity is somehow rattling around inside the, you know, that identity goes away. Okay. So they're just trying to give you all those little points. That's what you're getting at. And they're very careful, see, about, you know, that's a really clever way to do it. Real spiritual values in contrast to personality values. At the root, it's really the same thing. It's a double reflection of a single selfhood. Like Lucifer's selfhood, there's all kinds of goodness that went on for a very, very long time. There's a reflection in the Almighty, not in the adjuster, because he didn't have an adjuster, but there's a reflection in the Almighty there. And there's going to be personality values that go on, but it's not the Lucifer identity anymore. It's the Almighty identity. Even more really the supreme identity.
Could it have, what's going on, could it be the what Lucifer would have gradually developed into if he would have remained faithful? That's what gets absorbed. It's almost like the aspect of Lucifer before he went bad that really
all the potential that was there, see?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That potential is still going to get actualized.
Because he chose to go the other direction. He chose to bag it. And so, but that still has a momentum, and that's allowed to go on.
Right, there's a potential that will get expressed.
And what it is, it's the Father. It's the Father's touch in experiential reality, right?
Yeah, right. Right. So let's just stress that, because that'll help when we talk about love here in a little bit. So again, just stressing that. Remembering that there really is only one pool of purposing in a full top-down sense. I mean, there's just total will. Okay. But from a bottom-up point of view, We don't experience it as just a single pool of will, God the infinite. From a bottom-up point of view, it's delegated, it's doled out. A little bit of that purposing gets doled out to Chris. A little bit gets doled out to Maria. Well, gets doled out to Nick. But it really is all the Father's purposing still. You're not the source of that purpose. Yeah. I mean, you've been given the opportunity to be a means by which the Father's will can be expressed. That's why, not my will, but your will be done. See? I recognize that it's not my will. It actually is yours. And if it's going to have any reality, any ongoingness, I need to get out of the way. I need to let your will flow through me. Okay? It's the Father's will. Okay? It's also the Father's love. It's not your love. It's always the Father's love. You're just the means by which that love can come down into space and time and engage things in space and time. Ooh, there's a mystery of mysteries there. How does the Father's, absolutely, infinitely transcendent fact that is love get down into space and time and flow through and out from me? Yeah, it's just like everything that the Father does. It's a mystery of mysteries how any of this stuff gets into space and time when he has absolutely no relationship to it, comes to a focus point and gets expressed in some direction at some time. Okay, it's all deeply mysterious technically. Okay, but it's his love, it's his will. Okay, and you've been given the opportunity to be the means of its manifestation in space and time, or not, if you don't choose. If you don't want to be such a means to a greater end, fine.
That's just as true of a greater son as it is of us.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. As Jesus said, mm-hmm, when he was called good teacher, right, or good master, or whatever it was,
yeah,
he immediately denied that.
Right.
All goodness is.
Yeah, right. Again, he knows that it's his will. He knows that it's his love. He knows that, Michael knows that if he loves, he knows why. It's not because he did something really amazingly. And he's even a creator being, okay? He didn't create that love. It's his love. It's coming through him. Okay. all right. Let's see. Okay, so just, you can go back and you can reflect on that some more. And if it's still a little bit fuzzy, just try to get it as clear as you can, that the distinction between self and identity. And this whole bit about these reflective, as it were, copies of your selfhood that are both in the adjuster and in the Almighty. What would happen if you chose iniquity to those two copies?
Chris, I have a question. On that first sentence, if mortal man fails to survive natural death,
mm-hmm,
can he still fail to survive even though he does believe in God, or if he just chooses, he doesn't want to go on with the career?
I try to point out, you have to, not remember how it, in the sin sacrifice and atonement paper, it says that sin must be redefined to be deliberate disloyalty to deity, taking it way beyond anything that any human has ever imagined for a definition for sin, even more so for iniquity. Iniquity is so extreme. It is so beyond really, really violating taboos or transgressing taboos or any word that you can stick in front of taboo or anything like that. Iniquity is very difficult.
Right. I don't really want to talk about iniquity. It's about people who just decide they don't want to go.
But that's the only way you can not survive.
You can't just say, I don't want to do it anymore?
No, because Michael is forcing you, basically, to have an ongoing life. That's what happened at Pentecost. Guess what? Whether or not you've even given it any thought, you're going to survive this life. I've given you an embryonic soul by grace. You will be resurrected. Cluelessness, all cluelessness gets resurrected now. If you were completely clueless before, you know, had made not the slightest, you know, if you didn't have a, you know, an adjuster by grace at age six, you know, 3,000 years ago, I mean, you don't somehow get an adjuster just, you know, I mean, you've got to, it takes a supreme consecration to get an adjuster before that. I mean, so, right, I mean, yeah, so obviously you could say, oh, God, whatever. Okay, well, you're not going to survive then because you won't have a soul. But that doesn't happen anymore. Every clueless six-year-old gets a soul. You know, and they could stay clueless the rest of their life, and they still have a soul. They still get resurrected. They didn't have to have ever said the word God once in their entire life.
So isn't that against your will? If you don't, if Michael is pushing you and you don't want to do it?
Where does will come from? Outside of time. See, so don't impose a temporal thought on will. If you step back out of time, is it against will? No. I mean, eventually, you have to choose. You're not going to get all the way to eternity clueless. You're not even going to get off of Gerizim clueless. You're going to have to become aware, and you're going to have to choose God or not. Okay?
You got to be really committed to not survive.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, really.
So.
But hopefully by then you've been educated lot more.
Right. Hopefully. But, you know, issues can come into play. Lots of people were on the first mansion world, for instance, really focused on getting to God. They were really into this. They got, you know, they discovered that they woke up after they died in their mortal sphere, and they woke up on the first mansion world, and it's like, wow, I can see angels now, and it's all really cool. And the angels tell them about God, and they go, wow, that's really cool. And they're really working on going towards God. And then Satan shows up on the first mansion world and talks about the ideas of the God of Liberty. And you go, oh, that's even cooler. That person who was talking about God is now non-existent.
You mean Lucifer showed up on the first mansion world?
Huge carnage on the first and second mansion worlds.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He, remember, the worst thing was they went to the probationary nursery and try to corrupt the salvaged children of time. Okay. Right. There was massive iniquity on the first and second mansion worlds. People, I mean, think of this. You've managed to survive your mortal life only to obliterate yourself on the mansion worlds because of some meathead named Satan and Lucifer.
I don't understand how they could do that.
They chose. It's a choice. It's always a choice. You know, they went between the two camps. Here's the, you know, they studied the ideas of God the sevenfold as presented by Gabriel. Then they went over here and studied the ideas of the God of Liberty as presented by Satan himself, maybe, or Lucifer himself, or maybe Satan. They go, okay, ideas of God the sevenfold, ideas of the God of Liberty. Nah, I mean. Liberty. They chose liberty.
So that's it. From your earlier analogy, it sounds like they were weighing things in the balance with wisdom, but it was a subjective wisdom. It wasn't seeing into the essence inside.
Again, it's always a lack of insight. I mean, a failure of insight. That's why it's so sad to record that so few persons take delight in cultivating some insight. You know, if you haven't cultivated insight, you are highly susceptible to sophistry. I mean, it doesn't take someone as silver-tongued as Lucifer. Some doofus on this planet can feed you a spiritual line and you'll fall for it. Okay? There's demagogues with some silver tongues on this planet that suck people in all the time. I mean, the grace is, you know, you hardly live long enough here to get to iniquity. I mean, you die by grace before you can actually get to iniquity here. Okay, well, you don't have that grace on the first mansion world. You got plenty of time to get to iniquity on the first mansion world. Okay, you go, well, why doesn't God stop that? He can't. It's not that he won't. God cannot stop your choice. He gave you absolute free will, not relative free will. He doesn't allow it, permit it. He can't prevent it.
He already allowed it in the beginning.
He gave you absolute free will. God, you can trump God in that, in regard to eternity. Nothing else, of course. God trumps you in everything else. But in regard to whether or not you have a relationship to eternity, he has nothing over you. You can just snuff him out. You have absolute free will.
Her question is, then, that seems to contradict the answer that he gave you before, does it not?
You know, I'm just thinking about one particular person that is really tired of living and doesn't. So, I don't know.
Don't wake up and go on. See, again, Michael can dole out ongoingness as much as he wants. There's nothing, he can pour out mercy to the nth degree. And he's done it pretty much. I mean, pretty much every one he survives. But he has no say over the final judgment. That's the Ancients of Days. You know, but if Michael says on Urantia, where everyone is clueless, all clueless people are resurrected. And the universe says, okay, and they resurrect them all. Because that's what he wants, okay? It's like, well, this person, I mean, they went their whole life just purely selfish, hating everyone. They get to be resurrected? Yes. Okay, so now what is your subjective, you feel a tinge there? Your adjutant self should feel a tinge there. It's called the second level of meaning. It's called, that's not fair. I worked really hard to try to consecrate myself to God. That guy that didn't even do it one shred, he gets resurrected too? That's not fair. Second level of meaning. Michael said, no, fairness is irrelevant. I'm going to resurrect them all.
Chris?
Yep.
It strikes me as sad that the people who are, say, very conservative, who worry a lot about judgment and whether or not they're going to escape hell and whether or not they're going to survive, and they get caught up in all this fear and following all these little rules they have to do to survive.
Right.
That's really sad.
Yeah. See, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free from that self-imposed bondage. How sad is it that you spent your whole life just heaping that on yourself when you could have let go and lived?
I was saying that exact same thing today, how free I am of all the other stuff.
Of course, the flip side is all those people who recognize how silly that is to heap that stuff on, they go, free, free! Of course, then that's false liberty, and the next thing you know, you're, you know, a student of the Lucifer Rebellion. So, I mean, it tends to be a dichotomy on this planet. People who self-impose, you know, oppressively like that, and people who just throw the baby out with the bathwater, and morality never occurs to them, you know, again. You know, like I was pointing out, that's a big problem.
It always kind of pricks.
Yeah, it does. But yeah, right. I mean, yeah, the sixth and seventh adjutants and the three cosmic intuitions, you know, don't go away. You know, so it's always pricking at you. But if you Yeah, but again, you have to remember the personality trumps all this stuff. So even though your second cosmic intuition might still prick at you, you know, you can really say, oh, that must be tinges of that old fundamentalist thinking still, you know, haunting me. I need to really actively suppress that still small voice that's still haunting me.
Yes.
You know, so you got to be, you know, you got to be really careful, because now you're starting to see throw the baby out with the bathwater. Yes, you want to slough off arbitrary moralism. But don't slough off the Holy Spirit. Don't let go of the law, the recognition of the law of God. Yeah. So remember how we talked about the economy of Havona? You know, the rules of the house? You know, there's not one shred of variation in the law of God present in Havona. You know, you either follow the jot and tittle, every iota, every letter of the law, or you don't get in the door. Okay? The law is laid down in Havona. It's period. But you're totally prepared and open to that. Look up economy in the Central Universe paper. Just search for the word economy, and you'll see him talking about that. See, and that's what the word economy means. Yeah. It's the rules of the house. The nomi part. Kanomi, that's like astronomy, same nomi, that's laws. Astronomy is the laws of the stars. Economy is the laws of the house, or the laws of the domain that you're in. Okay. Yep. You got another?
I was just going to say that, Lucifer definitely was an advocate of that, let all the barriers loose, because, he said he accused the Finaliters of being, something of overmuch discipline, I don't know. It doesn't hurt to have these things going on. It's just that what I find with the Arantia book, you can realize that your conscience and the will of God aren't necessarily the same thing, and your conscience oftentimes is the mores impressing themselves to a large extent. But you got to be, like you say, careful.
Right. So again, that whole bottom up from fear, you have folkways and mores and taboos. You need to flip around. You don't want to just somehow have less primitive taboo notions or something like this. You want to start with moral consciousness, and then bring it down into ethics. You want to just totally remake that whole domain of your consciousness. Get it coming top down instead of all this confused bottom-up stuff.
I have another question. Uh-huh. You probably don't even know the answer because it's probably unanswerable. But how could that brought up the question, if they're up in the first mansion world, the second mm-hmm. mansion world, how in the world would they choose iniquity up there? And they've got angels around them to help. They've got Maharaja companions around. They've got the little animals,
we can't imagine how they could do that. But if you get your consciousness up, okay, if you get your consciousness up to where Lucifer's was, he could reject all kinds of high ministries. See, it's harder for a lowly being to reject a high ministry. But the higher you get, the more you can, that's not really that big a deal. I'm actually a little bit fancier than that angel. That's the thing. As you go up, the potential for self-love never goes away, see? Okay. To him whom much is given, not only is much expected, but much is required. You got to take it up a notch.
So that means ego is not an animal trait. It's going to be all the way up.
No, it's not just an animal trait. See, it's a self trait. And there's selves beyond animal origin selves. Lucifer had a self. And it became wholly egotistical in and of itself.
The less progressive people, the more primitive people, are naturally going to be more influenced by their environment. That's called docileness. Mm-hmm. As people get more of the of personal selfhood, which is part of progressing, but they've got to integrate it with that. So as they go up, so they become more where they can do things, creatively on their own. But like you say, it's a double-edged sword. So these people that get up to that level, the first mansion world, they've achieved a level of where they just don't go with what the rest of the group does necessarily. They've got enough personal consciousness functioning to where they can say, I think this way's better, no matter what they say.
It's just, we all know that what happens around 16, in general with the animal origin, it's just a higher expression of that. That's basically where that comes from. The 16-year-old thing, I don't need mom and dad anymore. That's just a downstepped expression, a shadow of a higher phenomenon. destiny. And all this stuff has a source on high. All right, let's get some more red here.
Human self-consciousness implies the recognition of the reality of selves other than the conscious self, and further implies that such awareness is mutual, that the self is known as it knows. This is shown in a purely human manner in man's social life, but you cannot become so absolutely certain of a fellow being's reality as you can of the reality of the presence of God that lives within you. The social consciousness is not inalienable like the God consciousness. It is a cultural development and is dependent on knowledge, symbols, and the contributions of the constitutive endowments of man, science, morality, and religion. And these cosmic gifts, socialized, constitute civilization.
Okay, so let's step through that a little bit. That first part, you know, what's between the lines of all that about self-consciousness, the recognition of an and connection to another person. Okay, now we're really reminded of this distinction is vital. You know, we have a cosmic system and we're connected to each other through the individuality of the whole. Okay, and it's just an automatically mutual thing. If I actually engage the triunity, I'm going to be connected through the individuality of the whole to others that have engaged the triunity, you know, and it's a two-way flow, a two-way connectivity. So that's, you can't have one without the other. You know, it's just automatic that you have this triunity personality engagement connectivity. But that's way above, you know, what you normally are talking about when you say social, just merely social. Okay. So they're trying to bring in that distinction. Okay, so now first of all, when they say the social consciousness is not inalienable like the God consciousness. Okay, well, in one way of thinking about that, that's a pretty obvious fact. If you're an animal with higher and higher adjutant engagement, you get up to a mammal that has a fifth adjutant engagement, that's the social adjutant. Okay? Higher animals have social consciousness. Now, like we've talked about a lot. Okay? It's a very, you know, especially if it's like an elephant or something, it can be very profound social consciousness. Or whatever. But just, you know, they have a social consciousness. Okay? But just distinguish. There's two different ways that you can have a social consciousness, merely bottom-up like an animal can only have, where it's the apex phenomenon. Or you can start at the top, you know, with a full God consciousness, you know, engaging the whole triunity, you know, like we pointed out, the fact and the law and the love, that whole triune connection to God. Okay, and then you start to bring that down. You know, like very definitively, your moral consciousness is downstepped as an ethical consciousness, you know, which establishes a social phenomenon, okay? So, but see, they're pointing out, yes, I mean, it's just a direct inalienable linkage that if you're human, if you're functioning as a human, you have this triunity nature up there in the upper domain of the hourglass. But you have to then work on bringing that down, you know, translating a moral consciousness into an ethical consciousness, translating faith into belief, translating logical recognition into rational thought, etc. All those. Yeah, an ideal into an idea, even. Yeah, think about that. I mean, that's a process. It takes effort to bring that down. It's not an automatic fact of being human. Okay, so that's what they're saying. See, that's, you know, it is a cultural development. You know, this whole process of bringing it down. You have to take the light and, you know, cultivating this, bringing this down. You know, it's not sort of just an innate ability, there's skill there. You can, that's another way you could say it. Yeah. Okay. So you have, you know, it is a cultural development and is dependent on knowledge, symbols, and the contributions of the constitutive endowments of man, science, morality, and religion. Ooh, another little gauntlet line there. Okay. If you want to really call yourself human, you can't just have a religion, or even a religion and a morality. You've got to have a science too, or you're delusional. That's not actually human. You've got to have all three, science, morality, and religion. Okay, and that doesn't mean that you do advanced calculus, you know, about particles, particle physics or something. That isn't what we mean by science. You have to have a genuine outer life relationship with facts. You have to have a science to your life.
Like paying bills.
Oh, well, just facts in general. It doesn't have to, you know, you don't have to always put it in, you know, in monetary terms and stuff,
right.
You know,
right.
or even material terms in a simple way, you know, got to make sure you feed yourself, blah, blah, blah. You know, I mean, think about it more philosophically, more abstractly, just in general. You have to have a relationship with individuality, not just unity. Okay, not just an inner life unity, but an outer life engagement of individuality and a linkage between the two, which is means it's genuine morality. Again, if you don't have a science, you don't actually have morality. You can't. I mean, you have to have science and religion, and then there's this linkage between the two. You know, this is the middle block here is the superadditive consequence of the relationship between the two. You have to have the two endpoints first. And as a just in just an initial actuality sense, it's merely a morality. You take it to full-throated nature, and then you're really talking philosophy. You know, see, morality is really the seeds of full philosophy. Okay? You know, and maybe I could just point that out, right? I mean, in the same way, you know, we brought up the spirit of truth, you know, and you initially notice in the actuality sequence you have fact, truth, goodness. But then you see truth down here again. Well, you have sort of just the actuality level of truth, but then there's the personality level of truth, full-blown objective sort of truth above that. Okay, and your relationship objectively to that truth. And a similar thing. I mean, I put, you know, you look at it, and it looks like, oh, you have science, philosophy, and religion. Well, remember, not all these triplets are at the same level. This is more fractal-like. Okay? You know, technically is a really foundational thing, like they're pointing out here. You'd say science, morality, religion. But I've chosen to put the sort of the next triplet up from that, where you grow that morality into philosophy, into full-blown philosophy. You bring in a full measure of personality. Same thing with fact, truth, goodness here. And then here you see beauty, truth, goodness. See, that's another one where you've taken it up a notch.
What's helpful to me, and I think it's accurate to say, if you take any two of those, make those the ends, then the other one is the mean.
Not totally.
Yeah.
You don't want it. I mean, they're not interchangeable.
Okay. As far as the super additive is what I'm
yeah.
saying.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to think. You don't want to let your unity consciousness equate these three. So that you can, well, I could put these blocks in any order. Now, I mean, there's only one that's individuality, and only one that's unity, and only one that's associativity. So that's absolute. Okay. Now, the spirit of truth of what you're saying is, yes, you can combine them in lots of ways, yes, but don't let that blur the real foundational distinction. I mean, no matter how high you ascend, there's still three levels in the local universe, three levels in the super universe. Those three levels are fundamental. They don't go away, okay? And those three levels are individuality, associativity, unity, okay? It's a there's absolute anchors of these three things. So no relative phenomenon supersedes them. They're immutable. Okay. All right. Let's see. Okay, then that last part. So you have this, you know, thinking about the distinction between or the improving your understanding of how social consciousness fits in a bringing in a top down, so that that what we're trying to do is not just a glorified animal thing. We're just trying to have fancier and fancier fifth adjutant stuff that we're doing, like a really fancy animal. But to turn it around, get a solid connection, you know, recognition of a duty to the cosmos first, which an animal can't do, and then predicated on that duty to the cosmos, you recognize you have a duty to others. So there's that social consciousness.
I don't understand what you mean by duty to the cosmos.
That's where there's no other individual in the universe but you and the universal harmony that you recognize is there. And you see its truth, beauty, and goodness. You see its rightness. You want to be like it. It has nothing to do with another person at all. See, moral consciousness doesn't involve another person. Moral consciousness is just you and the cosmos. Ethical consciousness is when you bring in another person. See, that is very key. That's a top-down understanding.
From the bottom up, mm-hmm. morality is not logical.
No, it seems arbitrary, right? I mean, to do what is moral, it's not because of its, you know, what impact it has on others or anything like that. None of those thoughts are in it. You just know, it's self-evident that that's right, regardless of what consequences or anything. It's just right. Okay, and that is completely, you know, nonsensical from a bottom up. When a person sees you doing that, they assume that you're one of those arbitrary fundamentalist absolutists, you know, that's just taken some random thing that you have a hankering for and absolutized it, you know, and, okay? No. We hold these truths are self-evident. Self-evident, not, oh, you can figure this out by interacting with others. No. No. Close your eyes and it's self-evident. Alone in a room, it's self-evident. It's not an experiential, interactive thing. See, it's shades of existential consciousness. The rightness just is. And then experiences flow from that. Okay. Moral consciousness, then ethical consciousness. Recognition of duty to the cosmos, then a recognition of duty to others, including a recognition of a duty to the other. One of those members in that cosmic system, the other, God. Be you perfect, even as I am perfect. You know? See, that's a recognition of a duty to one of those others, the other. But you're not going to even do that if you don't first anchor yourself in the cosmos. Then it follows that consequential duty to God to be perfect. But if you don't recognize that you're part of a cosmic system, I mean, that's just a nonsensical thing. And that's what Lucifer said. Lucifer said, I mean, that's just an abstraction. That God thing is just an abstraction. Okay? It's because he was letting go of his connection to the cosmos. If you're connected to the cosmos, God is not an abstraction. God is self-evident. And your duty to him is then self-evident. Okay? Cosmos first. You and the cosmos first, then the others, including the other. That's the top-down perspective. And, I mean, we coined the words ethical and moral with that recognition, but we've lost it. I mean, remember, we're in philosophic chaos now. Everything that the little things we used to know 2,500 years ago are basically all lost now. You know, and the run-of-the-mill person on the street is oblivious to this.
Yeah.
This
self-evident part, it reminds me, it's been in the news recently or on the radio that they're finding out through experimentation that children have like this inborn sense of fairness. Mm-hmm. They don't have to learn it. It's just there.
It's almost like there's a second level of meaning. It's almost like there's a second level of meaning. I mean, you just, you know, a parent notices that. It's like, wait a minute, I didn't really teach them that sentence. They just blurted it out one day. That's not fair. Where in the heck did that come from? Right, right. It's not the television. It's not, I mean.
They don't have to learn it.
It's there. Right. It's all put in us, yes. Yeah. And that's just the beginning. First just, next there. Then, you know, I mean, there's that whole hierarchy is put into you. Okay, so. So. You know, we're touching back to the end of paper six of section six here in paper 16. Remember when it talked about the three cosmic intuitions and how it's tied to education and civilization and personality and religion? And, okay, see, these three cosmic gifts, socialized, constitute civilization. I mean, that's why when they said that's the purpose of civilization to express the three cosmic intuitions. The three cosmic intuitions socialized is civilization. Okay, so obviously it's the purpose of civilization to express them. Okay, civilization is wholly a choice. It's wholly, you know, genuine civilization is wholly a choice predicated on that recognition in the upper domain, that objective consciousness, okay, and then you're manifesting it. There's nothing natural about civilization, like we're just about to read here. Yeah.
Civilizations are unstable because they are not cosmic. They're not innate in the individuals of the races. They must be nurtured by the combined contributions of the constitutive factors of man, science, morality, and religion. Civilizations come and go. But science, morality, and religion always survive the crash.
That's another, that's like what Joan was just pointing out. It's like it's just there, hardwired in. Yeah, there's three levels of meaning tied to the three intuitions. 4, 5, and 6. They're just there. Science, morality, and religion are just there. They're inalienable from human consciousness. They're not going to go anywhere. Okay? You know, even if civilizations crash, okay, you know. But again, you know, there's that gauntlet. The constitutive factors of man. It's like, well, we don't have science, morality, and religion. Well, guess what? Then you don't have human manifestation. And guess what? You're also not going to have civilization then. So don't be surprised if you find it hard to find. Okay, civilization is going to disappear. Okay, it has to be chosen and rechosen every moment, and only that which is chosen as a triunity by personality is upheld by the mother. If it's not, even if it's chosen, but it's not a full triunity thing, she's not going to hold it up. It's going to collapse. And it's like, well, couldn't she be nice and hold it up instead? Anyway. No, she can't hold it. She only triunity things rest on her hand. If it's not a triunity, it goes right through her hand.
No coupling.
There's no coupling to it, yes. You have to make it real.
So it's not a one-way relationship. She needs some reciprocation.
There needs to be science, morality, and religion.
Okay. I feel like our civilization right now, where we're at, is not probably not going to be upheld by her because it's not even...
Right, and that's why, you know, one of the reasons why the book is here. You know, civilization is in jeopardy. It's an emergency revelation. All right, give us some more here.
Jesus not only revealed God to man, but he also made a new revelation of man to himself and to other men. In the life of Jesus, you see man at his best. Man thus becomes so beautifully real because Jesus had so much of God in his life, and the realization, recognition, of God is inalienable and constitutive in all men.
Okay, so most of that is pretty straightforward. Just reminding you of all human knowledge, that which is of greatest value is to know the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it. Okay, yep, got that. We know that very well. Notice the little things I slipped in, though. The parenthetical recognition. Because, you know, think about it technically. You know, we're talking this threefold inalienable thing. That's just the Holy Spirit, the three cosmic intuitions, the recognition part, technically. You know, how much you've engaged that with your personality and realityized it, taken it from recognition to realization, okay, that's, you know, another issue. But purely the inalienable part is the recognition, is the threefold insight. Okay, so that's why they're sort of just qualifying themselves. But they're giving you the greater because they're certainly encouraging you to go beyond recognition. Because Jesus did. He went a long ways beyond recognition. He's, you know, realization, appreciation, and love. He's gone all the way up. Right, okay. Oh, and reminded there, back on the civilization point, you know, another thing to really reflect on there, a sobering thought. You have a lot of intellectuals, a lot of academicians and stuff that actively are trying to expunge the use of the word civilization from the language because they see it as an arbitrary imposition of one ethnic group over another, one ethnic group saying, I'm civilized and you're not, you know, you're a primitive, you know. And so they're trying to expunge the thought, the reflection of the word civilization from, yeah, see, okay, this is sad to record, and this is going to be catastrophic if they succeed. If they get us to all throw that out, throw out our human reflection process and just be fancy animals, no upholding.
Savages.
What was that?
Who's this that's making us do?
You and just pointing out, if you listen to a lot of intellectuals, you know, you'll see how there's this encouragement. It's like, you know, that civilization thing, that's the word of an oppressor. Yeah. People who are trying to oppress others use the word civilization as a club. What you need to listen to is the person who's the friend of men and angels and doesn't try to oppress people like that.
Liberation. Okay.
Right. See, this, you know, this, it's the Lucifer Rebellion. The Lucifer Rebellion in the ignorant minds of individuals has a thought like, you know, we should really work on getting the word civilization out of the language because that's an oppressor word. On and on and on, I guess. You know, you're a racist if you have a future time orientation. It's another intellectual thought. If you have a future time orientation, you're a racist. Because they're saying, see, because they look at people, they look at some primitive people on the planet and they don't have any future time orientation. They're very sangic, very place-like, very in the moment. And there's no difference. You know, we're all born equal. That's an unquestionable assumption. We're all born equal. So if there's any inequality, if there's any human inequality, it has to be the result of oppression, taking what was born equal and forcing it to be unequal by some conspiracy, some oppression. That's the Lucifer Rebellion. Okay? No, we are not born equal. Some of us are very primitive. Some of us have the potential of being not quite so primitive. Okay, there's a difference. Some of us can actually self-consciousize civilization. We recognize that it's an objective potential and we would like to choose it. There are others who are oblivious. Doesn't mean it's hopeless. You can show them civilization and the benefits of it and they go, ooh, yeah, I like that. I don't have to die tomorrow because you have, you know, order instead of chaos. I like this order. I never would have thought of that myself. But having experienced it, I kind of like it. I'll go with you on this civilization thing. But, you know, like future time orientation, what gives you a future time orientation?
Personality.
So if you reject that, if you call that racist, And hence, bias your thought against, like, wait a minute, I'm having a future time orientation. Oh my gosh, I'm being racist. You're actively trying to suppress your personality consciousness. It goes nowhere but down. Okay, and they have the best of intentions, these people are doing that, because yeah, they see the human inequality and they feel sorry.
They're doing very problematic. What I used to do as an Eastern religion devotee, and when they have a thought, they think the way to get to unity, they're looking for unity in the subconscious instead of the superconscious. And they're just dropping the thought and saying, I can't think of this because it's too discriminatory.
Right. And of course, too, that's just, you know, think of that dropping. What happens if you drop something? It goes to the bottom of the hourglass, 0th level meaning, what's there? Fear. So, yeah. Yeah. So not surprisingly, these people with all their high-minded notions are fraught with fear. Because they've let go of spiritual gravity. They fall to the bottom of the hourglass and they're fraught with fear. All right, a little more here.
Unselfishness, aside from parental instinct, is not altogether natural. Other persons are not naturally loved or socially served. It requires the enlightenment of reason, morality, and the urge of religion, God-knowingness, to generate an unselfish and altruistic social order. Man's own personality awareness, self-consciousness, is also directly dependent on this very fact of innate other awareness, this innate ability to recognize and grasp the reality of other personality, ranging from the human to the divine.
Okay, so just one little bit there to stress it, and let's not, you know, belabor it here, but again, unselfishness aside from the parental instinct. I just want to stress this because we've gotten stuck on this a few times. You have the basic first adjutant maternal instinct as one side of the parental instinct. You have that basic third adjutant loyalty instinct that a man tends to have pretty universally. He wants to be loyal to something, and he'll be loyal to his wife and his children, his family. But first and third adjutant instincts, you know, don't confuse that with fifth and sixth level of meaning stuff. You know, the level of selflessness, the fifth level of meaning, you know, and beyond, okay, and love. Okay? You know, so don't call those very appropriate and necessary instincts down there on the first level of meaning stuff way up high. Just reminding you of that, you know, the whole, like, altruism is when you combine the fifth and the third so that you have self-neutral mercy. You know, all this. So they're just all these things. You can reflect on the levels of meaning there. And again, how many times are they going to stress this threefold thing? It requires the enlightenment. Oh, it's going to say of religion, I bet. No. It requires the enlightenment of reason, morality, and the urge of religion. Science, philosophy, and religion. You know, God, actual God knowingness here, like they're saying, it's the fact and the law and the love, not just the love. I seriously doubt if anyone in here in this room isn't really solid on the love of God part. Yeah? But have you spent any time reflecting just on the fact of God, apart from love, just the fact? Reflect on the fact of God. Feel the fact of God. It will feel like the Isle of Paradise. It will bring a solidity into your life that the love of God doesn't. Okay? And then bring that fact of God into relationship with that love of God. And that's called morality, moral consciousness. What happens automatically when you bring those two together is your moral consciousness. All right, a little bit more.
Unselfish social consciousness must be, at bottom, a religious consciousness. That is, if it is objective, Otherwise, it is a purely subjective philosophic abstraction and therefore devoid of love. Only a God-knowing individual can love another person as he loves himself.
I'm going to do the last part in a second. But that first part. Unselfish social consciousness must be, parenthetically, at bottom a religious consciousness. Now, wait a minute. I thought the sixth level of meaning and having a real genuine religious consciousness, I thought that was the top, not the bottom. Oh, yeah, see? Turn it around. Make what was the top the bottom. Start there and work down. See, we've said it several times. They're saying it very directly there. Think about planting your feet at what now is way in the distance up above. Jesus said, I find you on the second level of meaning and I would lead you up. And when you get, you know, and if you follow him the way, all the way up, and you get up there, then flip around, plant your feet up there, and make everything new. Turn everything around. Establish a morality that results from a top-down flow rather than a bottom-up urge, etc.
What you were saying about Havona, that's the nature of things in Havona. Mm-hmm. When you get to Havona,
right,
the bottom becomes your religious consciousness.
The top at Uversa becomes the bottom of Havona. So then you build up from there.
They're advocating us to be like Havona.
Almost like the central universe is the pattern universe for everything out here. Yeah. See? Almost, yeah, see. Right. Okay, now that last part. Here's where I want to spend just let me touch on a couple things here. Because we talked about this last time. We all know love your neighbor as yourself, that you know, or like they're alluding to here, can love another person as he loves himself. It's like, well, Chris, you were really hard on this self-love thing last time. Doesn't that say love himself? Yeah, the problem is there's this very subtle line that you've got to draw. The line, for instance, between true and false liberty is so subtle that even high beings cross it unwittingly. There's this very subtle line of distinction that you must draw and figure out what this means and how it's the opposite of self-love. How is love himself a opposite of self-love? One simple little abstract recognition first, in the picture we always draw. You have the heart, that core of your nature, where the personalized self is. The not yet personalized self is off to the left here. The cosmos is off to the right. Okay. In that model, this love himself thing, how does that work? Where does the love come from? The temple within? No, it's not your love. Comes from the cosmos. So here's the love trying to come in. You're standing there. It can't get to the self. You need to step out of the way. You need to allow the temple to be a conduit for the Father's love to get to that self that needs it. Okay? That's technically how you do this, is you give permission for the Father's love to flow through your temple within to get to the self that needs it. Now the self is being loved. Okay. I just want to read a couple little paragraphs that talk about this double-edged sword complication with this issue. And, you know, how easily Lucifer slipped into it, and lots of humans slip into this. And they don't discriminate between loving himself, you know, loving yourself, and self-love. In the adjuster papers, in paper, let's see, this is 111, isn't it? Paper 111, section 6. Let's see, that's paragraph 2 in section 6. Oh, yeah, paragraph 2, which is at the top of page 1222 in the single column. Let me just read that paragraph to you. So this is in the section called The Human Paradox. Just right there to the side, there's another thing. That's a paradox. There's a thought that's just to the side of another thought. These really close thoughts, and you got to be careful not to switch from one to the other. That's what a paradox is. The courage required to effect the conquest of nature and to transcend one's self is a courage that might succumb to the temptation of self-pride. Okay. The mortal who can transcend self, yeah, the temple within, transcending that animal origin self, okay, might yield to the temptation to deify, no, it's lowercase d, bottom up, to deify his own self-consciousness. Okay. I'm the source of the love, for instance. The mortal dilemma consists in the double fact that man is in bondage to nature while at the same time he possesses a unique liberty. Ah, yeah, that biggest problem distinguishing true and false liberty, see, in the Lucifer Rebellion. He possesses a unique liberty, freedom of spiritual choice and action. On material levels, man finds himself subservient to nature, while on spiritual levels, he is triumphant over nature and over all things temporal and finite. Such a paradox is inseparable from temptation, potential evil, decisional errors, and when self becomes proud and arrogant, sin may evolve. Very close together, these two things. Loving yourself, letting the Father's love flow through the temple, and self-love.
I like how they fit the deify and the sin together.
Uh-huh.
There's our new definition of sin.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's deliberate disloyalty to capital D deity, but that deity word doesn't go away. Yeah, you become lowercase d deity. See, it's loyalty to lowercase d deity. It's yeah. Okay, then the other one is in paper 156, section 5, paragraph 14. Which is at the top of old single column, page 1740, that very first whole paragraph at the top. They're just a little paragraph. And I think maybe Chris even alluded to this last week. Maybe. This really great little paragraph about this in the Jesus Papers, where they try to give you some better words to use to keep this clear. Spiritual living mightily increases true self-respect. See, not self-love. True self-respect. But self-respect is not self-admiration. Okay? Let alone, you know, even more, a stronger word of self-love. Okay? But self-respect is not self-admiration. So that's the point of reflection. Reflecting on that very subtle initial, at least initially, distinction between respect and admiration. You've got to get it clear. It's a very tiny difference to start with, but if you pick the wrong one and follow it, one goes to oblivion and one goes to paradise. Okay? All right? Self-respect is always coordinate with the love and service of one's fellows. It is not possible to respect yourself. See, notice how they even see, instead of saying love yourself, they said respect yourself, just to make it a little bit clearer. It is not possible to respect yourself more than you love your neighbor. The one is the measure of the capacity for the other. Oh, and they used the word coordinate there too, didn't they? Okay. So now I'll go back to see the picture that they're painting and the technicality there when you see it, the word coordinate, the capacity. Right. You have the, you know, so when they say the one is the measure of the capacity for the other, you have a capacity, you have a temple within. If you consecrate it to be a conduit for love, then that love can flow through and get to it. But you know, if the capacity is only this big, then that's all the love that can flow through. If there's more capacity, then more love. You know, God's not magical. He can't somehow go around your temple and get to the self. The only way to get to the self is through the temple. So if you haven't taken delight in cultivating, having a very big temple within, well, don't expect a lot of love to be able to get to that self, no matter how much you want it to get there. You know, you can consecrate your will to the perfect will of the Father, but he's limited by how much you've consecrated your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother, how much capacity you have, how big a conduit for his love you've provided for him. He can't make it bigger. He's given you absolute free will over the size of that conduit. If you say small, that's all there is. A pint can't hold a quart.
You want to coordinate this with a teaching that we have about, following the story about the primitive man,
mm-hmm.
and that to really love someone, you have to understand them.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, I'm struggling between judgment and understanding. I mean, it seems like judgment is such a part of our lives. And to move beyond that to understanding, I'm struggling with that.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Well, and it's discriminatory. But, you know, the challenge is for, you know, like we talked about, they use that word discrimination in the description of all three cosmic intuitions. You know, again, there's subjective discrimination and there's objective discrimination. To get from judgment to understanding, you have to transform the judgment into objective judgment. To judge that individual as the Father judges them, not as you, brother, sister, judge them. Because that's a blockage to get to understanding. It's a lot, you know, things like forgiveness. A subjective idea of forgiveness is a roadblock. You got to take it up, like Jesus said. Love is never going to flow through you if you're still stuck down there in that subjective levels of meaning about what the word forgiveness means. You have to get it all the way up to patient love. And patient love is predicated on an absence of offense. You know, if you're going to be a conduit for the offenseless love of God, you have to be offenseless like him. You have to be godlike. The sixth level of meaning is godlikeness. You have to be like what's going to flow through. If you're not like what's going to flow through, it can't flow through.
Take that judgment, that anger, and lock that animal origin emotion being in the basement of your brainstem and recognize that it's there. You can't get rid of it. But you can take the top-down view and love it like a father, like you would love your tiger. You don't get in the cage with your tiger. You love your tiger. And then you go about your life keeping the tiger in the cage.
Yeah, I mean, just, not to belabor it, but just, you know, you have to be careful that animal origin nature that's, you know, basically in the lower domain of the hourglass, you can choose to bring it up and corrupt the upper domain. See, so you don't want to do that. That's kind of what you're saying. You know, keep it down there. You perforce to serve two masters. You can't somehow not have a lower domain of the hourglass. Okay, can't make it go away. Okay, but you can choose to live up here, not down there. And especially you can choose not to bring the issues of down here up in there and pollute the temple. Don't pollute the temple with it. All right, let's keep going so we don't run out of time here. Okay, so that's just, you know, if you want to reflect on those two paragraphs some more about that whole self-love thing, get that really clear. Be extremely biased, discriminatory against that distinction. Go at any hint of self-love with supreme prejudice. Okay? Give it no place.
There was the other quote that I thought you were going to bring in, is that all love comes with God, from God, and we receive the divine gift by bestowing it upon our brethren. And so you kind of, I see yourself as a, if you're not bestowing it, you're blocking it, and you can't receive it.
How many other paragraphs do you suppose in the book are relevant to this? Okay? Quite a few. Okay? You know, I'm just giving you two really good starting points, and then, you know, notice it in other places too. But work on it. All right.
Self-consciousness is in essence a communal consciousness. God and man, Father and Son, Creator and creature. In human self-consciousness, four universe reality realizations are latent and inherent. One, the quest for knowledge, the logic of science. Two, the quest for moral values, the sense of duty. Three, the quest for spiritual values, the religious experience. Four, the quest for personality values, the ability to recognize the reality of God as a personality and the concurrent realization of our fraternal relationship with fellow personalities.
Okay. Four bullet points. How many blocks are on the chart to my left? Four. Okay. Logical acumen, the logic of science, okay, et cetera. You see them, okay? And a lot of people have said, didn't you make this chart upside down? Shouldn't personality be the top one and matter the bottom one? No, what's the order in the book here? That order. Top down. One, two, three, four, this way. Why did they put it this way? Why didn't they put God first? Because this is not what? A religious text. It's a philosophic text. And the thing that the religionist is missing is number one. If you put number four first, you'll never get to number one. You'll get lost in four. You'll be lucky if you get to three. Okay? Grounded in science, you know. It needs to be grounded in science. This is the truthful order. Okay? If this challenges you, that's the whole point. It's a revelation. Figure out why the universal censor put them in that order. Chris didn't put them in that order. Chris is trying to think like the revelators. That's why he put them in this order. Okay? Okay? All right.
You become conscious of man as your creature brother because you are already conscious of God as your creator father. Fatherhood is the relationship out of which we reason ourselves into the recognition of brotherhood. And fatherhood becomes, or may become, a universe reality to all moral creatures because the Father has himself bestowed personality upon all such beings and has encircled them within the grasp of the universal personality circuit. We worship God first because he is, then because he is in us, and last because we are in him.
Okay. One quick little thing. I forgot. In the list, the tweaking of it with the word quest, there has to be a sequence that you're following if you're on a quest. There has to be an ing. Remember, we were referring to those ings. You know, the quest of personality values, that's the harmonizing personality sequence, see, et cetera. Okay, and meanwhile, back to this paragraph. And fatherhood becomes or may become a universe reality to all moral creatures because the Father has himself bestowed personality upon all such beings and has encircled them within the grasp of the universal personality circuit. I mean, we've bring in that one little thing, additional clarity. This, we're connected through the individuality of the whole. That personality circuit, we know what that's encircled in, her deity. It's the conductor for his circuit, okay? And then we worship God first because he is, then because he is in us, and last because we are in him. Does that sequence remind you of any sentence in the book? Like the first couple sentences of paper one? First, think of him as a creator, then as a controller, and lastly as an infinite upholder? Is it parallel? Let's see. Okay, first, because he is. First, think of him as a creator. Okay, yeah, I mean, that's the basic idea. You recognize there's a creator. There has to be an existential being that creates things. It has to just be in order to create the stuff that we experience. Yeah, first, think of him as a creator.
It's also number one, the knowledge of God.
Mm-hmm. He is. Okay. Then, because he is in us. Well, first thing of him as a creator, then as a controller. Well, does that work? He is in us. Well, I know what they're talking about there. They're talking about the thought adjuster. But at the beginning of the adjuster papers, they give you that fun little thing. First you could call it a thought changer, then a thought adjuster, and then when it's fully engaged and functioning as the Father wants it to, what's it called? Thought controller. First think of him as a creator, then as a controller. Okay. And lastly, as the infinite upholder. The infinite upholder, that ubiquitous presence. Yeah, we're in him. Okay. Yeah. Yep, sure enough, it is. So now you could obviously come at that in some different ways too, but just I wanted to make sure you see that. I mean, it's tie it to deity. Seek to really get the philosophic points founded, firmly. The book starts out with deity, not with God. This list we just read ended with God, didn't start with God, etc. They're really trying to get you to discover the philosophic text, because what flows through that triunity domain? Truth. They want you to get to the truth. Okay. All right. Well, and lastly, in paper 16, we have...
Is it strange that the cosmic mind should be self-consciously aware of its own source, the infinite mind of the infinite spirit, and at the same time conscious of the physical reality of the far-flung universes, the spiritual reality of the eternal Son, and the personality reality of the universal Father? Sponsored by a universal censor from Uversa.
So answer the question, is it strange? No. It's top-down, nothing strange about it. If it's bottom-up, it's very strange. Matter of fact, it's not possible and you reject it. Okay. Top down, very straightforward. Okay, so that first thing, cosmic mind coming down from above, it's the source, the infinite mind of the infinite spirit. And you notice it's lowercase infinite mind there, because they're just talking about the infinite spirit. Let's rephrase it in a different way. Instead of saying the infinite mind of the infinite spirit, we could say the infinite mother spirit as the infinite mind. Then I capitalize the I and the M. Okay. And that's even a little bit more of a unity than an individuality approach to it. Bring that in. Okay, so that just other points of reflection. Bring in some of the philosophic perspective. The spiritual reality of the eternal Son. If you want to really focus on the spiritual reality of the eternal Son, you wouldn't use the designation the eternal Son, because that's if you want to really focus on the personal fact. But if you want to really focus on the spirit, you call him the absolute spirit. So instead of saying the spiritual reality of the eternal Son, you could just say the absolute spirit, capital A, capital S. Says the same thing. Or the personality reality of the universal Father. Gene, can you think of how would you bottle that all up into one of these proper designations? You wouldn't call him the personality absolute. That's the second source and center. What would you call him? The personality reality of the universal Father. That would be?
Father absolute.
The volitional absolute. Exactly.
Good
Very good. All right, see you soon.
I think of it because I don't really understand.
But that's a fun one. That was the main reason why I was doing this little exercise. I wanted to remind you again of that. You know, because when it says the personality, reality, the universal father, you have a tendency to maybe just kind of even super consciously think personality absolute. Yeah.
That's the sun.
That's the sun. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So again, it's a point of reflection. What's the contrast between the personality absolute and the volitional absolute? Yeah. If I can begin to distinguish that, I'm actually beginning to separate the father from the son.
I don't recall you ever saying volitional absolute.
If you listen to recordings, you'll hear it. but yeah, the volitional absolute. You know, the father's personality circuit, you know, is a volitional circuit. I mean, it's a circuit. Something's flowing. Volition is the flowing of will, the exercise of will. I mean, literally, just will can't be in circuit. It's a static concept, basically. It's a potential. Okay. The motion is the volition. That's what's going in the circuit. He's the volitional absolute. He's the anchor point of that volitional circuit, okay, of that flow. All right. So there you have it. Lots about the three cosmic intuitions and things that are closely tied. You know, and you see, when all is said and done, a lot of really solid grounding in the fact of personality, in contrast to self, selfhood, identity, animal origin. You know, you can see how much they use this opportunity to try to make that point. All right, so now we're going to kind of set ourselves aside a bit. The other half of the story about the Supreme Spirits is to kind of pick up where we left off in the first part of this paper. We were really getting into talking about the Master Spirits. Well, what about the rest of the Supreme Spirits? So that's the next paper. We'll pick that up, and we'll get back kind of into the big picture again. But hopefully, you feel like you're a part and a member of a cosmos that has these other individuals now a little bit more by reflecting on this. All right, let's take a moment.